you so much for joining us today. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people that society places limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will be." And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better, more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For anybody who doesn't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, and then, and somebody just sent me this saying, or my daughter just gave this to me actually for Mother's Day, just when the caterpillar thought its life was over, it reforms into the butterfly. It isn't still strong enough to fly, though, so it has to struggle still while it's in the cocoon to get those wings strong enough to carry it everywhere it wants to go. I can't imagine that that's easy, but neither is busting through the limits that society places on people. And today, I am so excited to jump into my conversation with Christina Torres, because she is a lover of behaviors like I am. And I talked with her a few weeks ago, and we had an instant and wonderful connection. And I know today is going to be the same. I do want to get through all the businessy kinds of things of, you know, just letting you know if you're watching live to give us a hashtag live and where you're from, or if you're watching this in replay to give us a hashtag replay and where you're from. And then if you have any questions or comments, please post them in the chat, and then I can pop them up on the screen for all of us to see. And I just had one myself that I was trying to pop in there, and it's not going. So there it goes. Okay. And so I just popped in all of Christina's social media links, and I will be popping in all of her different websites that she'll be able to explain to you. I think that's all of the business stuff for now. It's enough for me anyway for a while. So Christina, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. So my name is Christina Torres. I'm here in Connecticut. I'm a board certified behavioral analyst, a BCBA, and I've been working in the field of autism and special needs since 2014. And I decided to start my own private practice. It's called ABA Made Easy, because I really wanted to kind of disseminate our science and make user-friendly resources accessible for everyone involved who supports our learners. So that's kind of like a little bit of my story and why I'm here today.
Awesome. And so I did pop in your website. And then tell us about these other two locations. You were kind of explaining them to me before we came on air.
Yeah. So this first link, abamadeeasy.com, is my actual official website. There you can find my resources. You can hear a little bit about me. And there's also opportunities to book consults. My Stand store, because I am on social media, I guess you can kind of consider me like a influencer, because I do support the ABA community and especially like the grad students and other professionals in the field. And I like to go live, answer questions and offer that mentorship that I wish I had when I was in the field. So with that Stand store link, there's also resources, but also learning events and webinars and mentorships that I'm going to be offering. And I do offer at this moment. And then the last website is my partnership affiliation with Special Learning. So Special Learning is a special needs platform, and they offer a ton of online trainings, like the 40-hour RPT training, CEUs for that multidisciplinary team, especially in the school. So I'm excited for that partnership, and that's where you can find a bunch of online training and resources there.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. And then I'm just going to pop this in really quick. These are all of your social media links. It looks like you're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. You're like me. You're everywhere. It just seems like every time you turn around, somebody's saying something to you on social media. So that's awesome. So tell us a little bit more about yourself. I know that you just mentioned you have a new two-year-old. Just recently, I should say, two-year-old.
Yeah. So my daughter, she was actually a 25-weeker. She's the reason behind I actually started my business. So I went into preterm labor. She came at 25 weeks. She was 1 pound, 8 ounces, literally the size of the elf on the shelf, the same dimensions and everything.
And oh my goodness.
I know. It's so funny. Like, her diaper was literally like this big when she came. So we spent 4 months in the NICU, and then she came home, and she just motivated me to like I've been in the field for almost 10 years now, right? And it's like, I need to, you know, I know that I'm competent in what I can provide. So I'm like, I'm going to start my consulting business. I want to be a present mom. And I'm a first time mom too. So it's like, I wanted to balance that work life, you know, lifestyle and offer and still support my community while also being a present parent for my daughter. So she just turned two a couple of weeks ago and she's so happy, healthy, funny. She's so silly. And it's just a joy being a mom. I really love this phase of my life.
That's awesome. That's so touching to know that a 25 week pregnancy is now 2 years old and thriving and doing beautifully. It really speaks to miracles and the power of medicine. So
absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Praise the Yale NICU nurses and all the people that contribute to supporting preemies, especially that micro preemies. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And yeah, the size of the elf on the shelf, that's a great picture. I mean, because almost anyone I would think knows about the elf on the shelf, but that's, oh my gosh. I mean, just thinking about how tiny she was when she was born. Just incredible.
I know. It was so funny. It was crazy too, because she came 4 months early, obviously. So I had my pregnancy app and it's like, oh, your baby's the size of a banana. And it's like, I'm watching the phases of her outside of my body on the app. And I'm like, wow, it was pretty spot on too.
Wow. All right. So it's interesting because I think automatically that because she was at 25 weeks and we don't think, you know, that everything is developed yet at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that she is going to be someone that society may have already placed limits upon. Mm-hmm. Have you had any kind of experiences with that?
Absolutely. Like before I went into the emergency C-section, right before it, you know, the doctors sit you down, have you sign a waiver and say, hey, listen, to make a long story short, your child can come out with cerebral palsy, autism, neurological disorders. They listed a whole bunch of disabilities or possibilities that your child can come out with. And it's just kind of like the expectation was already placed of like, you know, I remember her dad was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, we're going to love her. She's still our kid. What do you mean? Like,
right.
So, and even after that too, like being in a NICU for so long and then especially like coming home and, you know, people are like, oh my God, she's so little, or like, oh yeah, she had a preemie and everything's like, oh, well, at least she looks happy. You know, it's all those kind of like words, like at least this, or, you know, and just kind of like that, like, oh, like, and it's like, it's not like, oh, it's like, she's thriving, you know? So absolutely. Right. There's a bunch of different perspectives that come with expecting like there could be something wrong. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly it, that we tend to, without realizing we're doing it, diminish someone's potential by our thoughts, because we're thinking, oh, that's so sad. And the reason we think that's sad is because, oh, they're just not going to live up to, you know, someone who was typically born, was typically developing. And so that's actually kind of the concept of this, is it's not that people are physically placing limits. It's that mindset idea of you can appreciate all the gifts that everybody brings to the world, no matter what those look like in comparison to what you think a gift should look like or what your own gifts look like.
Yeah. Or like standards too, like the milestones, you know, as being a preemie, we have to go to the NICU grad program every 6 months and they check her milestones and they give you the actual, you know, milestones for the age. And there were always no, 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 no. But that does not really show what my daughter can do. Right.
Right.
So I would always share with my community, like, oh, this is what her milestone is. Nope. 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 But also too, it's like, at least I know what to look for, as in like, oh, that's going to be one of the goals to look for, at this developmental stage. You see what I mean?
Right.
So it's not invalidating her potential right there. It's like, okay, she's not there yet. And I understand why she's not there yet. But now I have a little task analysis of milestones to actually look for when she is at that specific milestone.
Right. And I love that you use the word task analysis, because that plays into exactly what you do in your job.
Yes. Okay. So guys, if you guys are not familiar with task analysis are, it's basically you take one task, right, and you break it down into really like, for instance, making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or simply brushing your teeth, right? A lot of people don't realize how many steps are involved with brushing your teeth. You got to turn the water, reach for the toothpaste, take off the top, squeeze it, or maybe the top is one that you got to flip open. So now you got to maneuver that kind of thing. And how much do you squeeze? There's a lot of behavioral and perspectives to be mindful of. So that's what we do in my field, in behavior analysis. What we do is we take a behavior, we break it down into little steps that are achievable. And that's how we kind of build skills for our learners with autism or other needs, but not necessarily just learners with autism. It's behavior in general. I use TAs all the time, everywhere.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I think that's a big misconception, is because we do look at the final product in when we're thinking about learning, as opposed to all the, and like you said, there are so many steps. I so often in IEP meetings will hear, you know, teachers say, well, they can't follow one step directions. And I'll ask them what the one step direction is. And they'll say, oh, for example, you know, get your book out of your desk. Okay. Well, that requires more than one step. Mm-hmm. Because you have to, you know, like, okay, am I at my desk? If I'm not at my desk, I have to go to my desk. So that's a step. Yeah, and then if I'm at my
whole step.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, where in the desk is my book? You know, is it the kind where you have I don't even know if they make those kind of desks anymore where the lid comes up, or they have the kind where it's underneath the seat, you know, so that's another step, you know, and then finding the exact book that you need out of all of the books that are there. You know, and I'm like, yeah, that's more than one step. And they don't get that. They're like, but I just gave them one direction. I'm like, yeah, but there's a lot of steps in that direction.
Yes. They're seeing. And so to translate what you just explained from like an ABA perspective, that's a terminal behavior, right? Go get your book is a terminal behavior. And then in our field, we call it shaping. So successive approximations to terminal behavior. So what are the baby steps to get to getting the book? And exactly, well, you got to stand up. Where are you? Are you on the carpet? Well, you got to get up, look at the direction of your desk, walk to your desk, peek inside your deck, flip it open. So it's a whole like process to get to where you're asking. So if your learner does not have the prerequisite skills of scanning or navigating the room, then they're never going to accomplish the step. So you got to teach the skills so that they're a little cusp to be able to reach this terminal behavior.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for explaining that. And I, like I said at the beginning, you and I love behaviors so much, and I am constantly learning. And kudos to you, first of all, for anybody who doesn't know, the requirements to become a BCBA are enormous. I've actually looked into them because of how much I love working with behaviors, and it's just too much for me. I mean, you have to spend, what is it like? You have to get 2,000 hours of intensive observation time, and that's not paid, and plus the degree and all the other, and then there's this massive test. And what other daunting requirement?
Yeah, so in order to become a BCBA, you have to earn a master's in applied behavioral analysis. And if you already have a master's, then you would have to take an ABA certificate course. So there's a lot of teachers actually transitioning to become a BCBA because of they see the perks of understanding it from a different lens. So once you graduate your master's, you can start your supervision hours once you start your grad program. So it takes about 2 years of full-time work. And some companies you are able to get it paid for if you're working in the field, which is the goal, right? Like, okay, you're kind of knocking out two birds with one stone. So you get your master's, you do your supervision hours, and then you have to sit for the board exam, which I failed, proudly failed my first time. So don't give up after the first time, guys. It builds character. And then it's expensive. And then I pass the second time around.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. Because I think so often we think, I failed this. This must not be for me. Or, this is super hard. Or it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for sharing that you didn't do very well the first time and had to do it again. And I really think that that's probably several people, if I don't want to say a lot, but quite a few people, because I've heard that test is really daunting and strenuous.
Yes, the passing rate, I think it's like 56%. And also be mindful that I know a lot of people that try to pass the exam like six times, because you have a 5-year window to, once you start your program, to be able to pass the exam. And then if you cannot pass within that 5-year range, there's like a new, they update the current task list. So then if you fail, you'd have to go back to school to get more classes. And a lot of people are like, you know what? Now they have a master's in applied behavior analysis and they can't even do anything with it. So It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. But don't stop. Yeah. Keep going. You'll get through it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do. I have mad respect for anybody who has actually gone through the BCBA and has officially become one because of all the requirements and the amount of time and the money and everything that's involved. Yeah. So mad respect for your skills there. So, let's talk. So we've talked a little bit about your own child, but let's talk about, you know, we kind of started delving into that about schools and behaviors in schools. And so, as you mentioned, working with behaviors, you know, yes, yours is ABA, but it doesn't only apply to kids with autism or people with autism. So that kind of leads me into a question of, is there an age where shaping behaviors won't work?
Honestly, I don't think so. Because if you could really break down a skill into small achievable steps, but you're supporting the learner and meeting them where they're at and learning how to shape and fade out those prompts so that they are able to accomplish those steps, you can shape anything. It's just, you have to be consistent. You got to be really compassionate and really work together as a team. That's really all it is when it comes to shaping behavior. You have to be consistent. You got to be supportive. Everyone has to work together, especially in the school system. And it's actually your behavior that has to change in order to support our kids and shape other people's behaviors, which people don't realize that.
Right. And that is so huge. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's not just the person whose behaviors we want to change that are going to change. It also needs to be us. And can you talk a little bit more about that, expand on that somewhat?
Yeah. So how behavior analysis works, let's say we're in the school setting and we have a learner that's, you know, property destruction, aggression, all the stuff that's not in the schools. The schools will reach out to BCBAs. Hey, we're struggling over here. We need help with this learner. As a BCBA, we go in, we analyze we conduct the FBA, that stands for functional behavioral assessment. And what we do is we take data and we're analyzing what's going on before the behavior, what's going on after behavior. And then what we do is we collect all the data, we interview the teachers, hear their perspectives, and then we come up with this whole plan and we share different strategies and ways to support this kid. And a lot of the times, you know, especially, for example, you know, school starts in August, we come in September, October, November, 3 months of them experiencing all this behavior. Now, you know, we come in and we, hey, this kid needs accommodations. You got to be mindful of this. Maybe it's the position where he's at, you know, lower the tasks. Also, too, when it comes to behavior, response effort is something to consider. But also, too, when you're looking at behavior, you have to ask yourself, is it a skill or is it a will, right? Is it a skill deficit or is it the willingness not to participate? So basically we just come in, we analyze what's going on and we create a behavioral intervention plan. And in that plan, there should be antecedent strategies, which everyone should be focusing on what to do before. A lot of people want to know what to do after his behavior while he's engaging. Well, if you actually focus on the accommodations, the modifications, the proactive measures, you might be able to highly likely build rapport with your learner, which is what you need to do, right? But also you can prevent a lot of things because you're inserting yourself prior to those precursor behaviors and, you know, supporting them where they're at. And that's where the behavior of you come in, because you, depending on how you react or the antecedent strategies that you implement, it's you that has to do that, not the learner. So it's like, you know, be proactive, be mindful of this and support them where they're at. And by doing so and staying consistent, you're going to see the decrease in behaviors because you're going to be proactive and mindful of, hey, the function is this, be mindful of that. And you're changing the environment to set it up for success for you and the learner, but also everyone else in the classroom. Because it's not just one person. You have to be mindful of everyone that is in the same room where that behavior is occurring.
Right. And that brings up a question that I've been hearing frequently, and I'm not really sure why. It's just recently that this has popped up so much, is when we're talking about a classroom and we're talking about students who have some, I would call them like the big behaviors, like you were talking, you know, like they're throwing things, they're, you know, the desks are getting overturned, that, you know, whatever, they're screaming loudly. And we have special education law that says those students have a right to a free, appropriate public education. What about the rights of the other students in the room? You just mentioned it. Like, how do you kind of balance that between the two groups?
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? There are others. There's so many people involved, and the other students absolutely are entitled to have quality education and learn too. But it's like, you have to meet everyone where they're at. If, especially in the beginning of the year, having that flow, having that consistency, understanding like, oh, he might need a little bit more time to process. He might need visuals to help with transitions. He might need a little bit more attention as in, hey, you know, let me compliment him for sitting nicely over here, because, you know, he's probably seeking attention. Attention is one of the functions. And sometimes our learners gravitate to seeking negative attention because that's the only way that they get attention, you know? So to be mindful of it's just honestly understanding where every learner is in the classroom, but also supporting the teachers, because you don't know how many children you're going to have with IEPs in your classroom. And also too, a lot of our kids come with accommodations. So if you can be mindful of different strategies that can support the class as a whole, but especially like being mindful of learners that do have a little bit more needs, then you're going to be able to kind of like find that middle ground to support everyone involved. So it gets tricky. Yeah, I see all the time. And it's like, sometimes the setting is not appropriate for this learner, you know, and sometimes it is, but over, you know, it's a shaping process. So you have to give time to see if it's going to work and then kind of go from there.
Right. So you've mentioned the word shaping a couple of times, and I know that's the technical term. When outside people who aren't familiar with ABA therapy hear that word, it sounds manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your response when people say that ABA is unethical, or ABA is, you know, it doesn't teach the children anything. It's just manipulating them to behave a certain way.
Yeah. So in our field, we have a lot of words, right, that are coming from like a behavior analytics science background. So that does not translate well into like our everyday English terminology. I actually have a resource called like ABA jargon to everyday speech, because it doesn't translate well. So whenever we're using terms like that, and it's like, oh, that's very manipulative. But if you understand it from our lens, then you will actually be like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. Like, hello. So when it comes to the manipulation of things, you have to understand everything is individualized, right? So it's all based off our learner, their tolerance, what they can do independently. And slowly, when it comes to shaping, you want to build the learner's confidence, right? You want to provide them the skills and strategies that they need to be able to succeed in the environment that they're in. So we're going to meet them exactly where they're at. And if, especially when it comes to like topography of behavior, which is basically how behavior looks. So for example, if we have a learner that is yelling and is very aggressive, like, get out of my face. And we're teaching them, hey, you can ask for a break, or I need to take a walk. I need to take a walk. Thank you for letting me know. Let's go take a walk. But since some adults will be like, well, you need to tell me nicely. And it's like, no. He's using his words right now. And who cares what it looks like right now? Because in this moment, he's using it. And eventually he's got to trust that if I tell you I need a break, the next time he asks for it, he's not going to be at this intense feeling. I need a break. Okay, perfect. And then that is that's what shaping looks like. It's understanding the topography is going to change, but you have to teach the skill so the learner knows, oh, this works, and I get to escape whatever they're trying to avoid. So that is what shaping is being patient and understanding, hey, this might look like this now, but in a little bit of consistency and being Building that trust with the learner, it's going to shape to something more socially appropriate, which is instead of yelling, he could raise his hand or go by himself and take a break.
Right. And thinking about that, how much time is involved typically? Is it like, oh, you know, Christina came in with her team and now all of a sudden everything is beautiful because they've worked with the student for one day or one week?
Yeah. Okay. So in our field, right, we have schedules of reinforcement, right? And one of the things is called intermittent schedules. So basically, see it like a slot machine, right? You go to the casino and you put a dollar in and maybe you hit, or maybe you got to put $20 in, or you're there for 3 hours and then boom, bingo, right? You don't know when you're going to hit. That's exactly how, especially when behaviors have been reinforced for a long time, as in like, okay, this kid is always for 3 months, all this behavior. It's not overnight, but it can be depending on how fast the kid realizes, oh, if I just do this, it replaces that. You see what I mean? I could shape a behavior in 3 seconds, or that same behavior could take 3 months. It really depends on the learner and meeting the learner where they're at and supporting them and slowly shaping the support that they need to be successful. So you don't know how long it could take. It could take seconds or it could take weeks or years sometimes. Right.
And I don't have all the training that you have, but I know with the students that I've worked with who have had a lot of unwanted behaviors, I was never able to do it in 3 seconds. So it was always much longer than that. So if you can do it in 3 seconds with anybody, that's amazing.
Well, I'm thinking
where
about
all that extra training comes in.
Yeah. And also too, guys, my expertise is definitely like early intervention. Right. I love working with the kids and like teaching new skills, but kids learn quick and fast when they are having fun. So if you can make the kid laugh and like repeat something and just be silly, they're going to grasp concepts quick because they're reacting off of how you're reacting. So it's like, oh no, you know what I mean? And then they'll do it again and they'll do it again. And then it's like, wow, he just learned, like, for instance, last night, my daughter's 2 and she's got her hair in her face, like every toddler, right? And so, yeah. Like, I'm thinking about she's at daycare. So I don't want her to be eating and getting stuff all over her feet. So the other day I was playing with her and I'm like, oh, we got to get your hair out your face. And so she's looking at me and she's laughing. And then I'm like, get your hair out your face. And then I was like, you do it, Snowy. And she did it. I was like, and we did it like 3 times. And then I was playing a little bit. And then I'm like, oh, you got to get your hair out your face. And she did it all by herself. And that literally, I taught her a crucial skill that's going to help her in 30 seconds, literally probably like 2 minutes. But that's what I'm saying. Like, you can make the environment enriching and understand like, oh, let me teach this. Like, let me shape this behavior. That's what I did. I shaped her behavior of understanding, oh, move your hair out of your face. Now she's going to have a clean face.
Yeah. So absolutely. I think too, you know, the younger, the better. And we talked about, you know, was there an age? And I agree with you that there really isn't. As far as, I'm going to word that question from before a little bit differently. So if there's not an age, is there a depth or a degree, a frequency or a duration of an intensity? I'm using the technical terms that I'm aware of a behavior where it is beyond being able to be shaped at any age.
You have to be mindful of the different barriers too, right? So when we are working with learners that have autism or other abilities, it's more than likely sometimes our learners have dual diagnoses, right? Oh, they have autism and then they have ODD and then they have ADHD. So depending on the amount of barriers that might be interfering with shaping behaviors, it's going to look a little bit different. And also too, you got to think of other like genetic disorders, like Williams syndrome. Williams syndrome is known to have like a lack of motor and muscle tone. So that's also going to influence like, oh, she can't zip up her coat, or it's going to take her a while because she has a hard time with the motor piece. So when it comes to like, okay, the intensity and the support, it's really understanding exactly where that learner is, but also what medical barriers are in place, and also what kind of supports can we add, or accommodations, right, or modifications, so that they are able to achieve specific behaviors. So everything really is individualized depending on the amount of barriers or support a child may need, and, you know, the consistency and support that they have when it comes to gaining new skills too, you have to also be mindful of the amount of learning opportunities that you're allowing them to actually engage and practice that new behavior and skill. So if you take that opportunity away from them, how are they going to learn? How are they going to be able to practice that skill that's going to lead them up the staircase to other functional behavioral behaviors that they can engage in to generalize, you know, in the future? Like, for instance, fine motor, zipping up the jacket, right? Especially in the school setting, you come home, they arrive at school, they put the coat in the locker, they go to recess. So arrival, recess, back in from recess, leaving. That's four opportunities that a learner can practice that important skill. Because, oh, why do they need to learn zipping? Well, they got to zip up their coat. They got to zip up their backpack. They got to unzip their lunchbox. You see what I mean? There's zipping is an important skill that nobody's thinking of how it's going to generalize in the real life. It's a functional skill, guys. So don't just take the opportunity away from them. Please give them patience and allow them to practice that skill.
Right. So one of the things that I teach when I talk about behaviors, and one of the things, like when I would work with other teachers on trying to get more wanted behaviors in their classrooms of our students, is that sometimes, and the three words that I use are intensity, duration, and frequency. Mm-hmm. So, and by intensity, like how severe it is, duration, how long it lasts, frequency, yeah, how often it happens. And I did want to go back. You did use a couple acronyms, and I always try to describe the acronyms. So ODD is oppositional defiant disorder, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So oftentimes, if one of those three, intensity, duration, and frequency, would start to decrease, one of the other two would often start to increase. Do you see that when you're working with your students, or was that just something that I was not doing correctly that was making that happen?
Okay, so we had three behaviors, and you said another one increased. Can you explain that again?
Yeah. So I always talked about intensity, frequency, yeah, duration. And so many times, okay, got it.
Yeah. I'm thinking about extinction bursts, right?
Okay.
When we're replacing a behavior, right, it still has to serve the same function as to why they were engaging. So let me explain the functions. There's four functions of behaviors. Okay. One of them is escape and avoidance. Right? Think about it. If you're scared, you're going to go the opposite way. You're going to avoid whatever it is. In the school setting, usually learners are engaging in escape maintained behaviors because they don't want to do the work. Oh, why don't they want to do the work? Well, maybe they don't have the skill set to be able to accomplish the work, and they don't have the modifications, or they're not motivated, right? The other one is automatic and sensory. So that's stimming, right? Our learners with autism, they stim, they hum. That's also self-regulation. Whenever you get bit by a mosquito, you scratch yourself. This is all automatic. You're going to do the behavior in front of people or without people present. There is no social piece. The other one is attention. Attention is a huge one, okay? And attention could be good attention, and it could be bad attention, okay? It's a whole spectrum of attention. And the other one is tangible. Access to something. We work to earn money to buy tangible things, right? In the grocery store, a kid is denied access to this $60 toy, so they start having a tantrum. So that is what happened, and that's the function. They were denied access because they didn't have access to that tangible. So when we are shaping behaviors, we have to determine the function. And usually in the school, it's escape. So how are we going to allow this kid to still escape, but do it in a way that's more appropriate and socially significant? So if he is property destruction, yelling, being disrespectful because he doesn't want to do this math sheet, and I say, hey, instead of doing all that, you could just let me know, I need help. I don't get it. You know, maybe if you have a math sheet that has 10 problems, fold the paper in half, and now there's only five. Circle three, like, hey, can you just do these three? Do you want to circle the three, or should I circle the three you want to do? You see what I mean? You meet the learner where they're at, but you have to increase their motivation to accomplish that. So what you're explaining is an extinction burst, right? If a kid is used to, this is working, I don't want to do it. And then we say, oh, you just have to use this. And they're still doing this. And it's like, oh, you just got to let us know you need a break. Then their behavior is going to kind of increase until they realize, oh, this actually works. And it's low response effort because I don't have to spend 45 minutes fighting with you. I could just tell you, hey, I need a break. So that's what you're going to see when you do replace this behavior with something more socially significant. And it takes a little bit of time, but eventually this learner needs to know, like, hey, you don't have to do this anymore. You can still escape, but just do it this way.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you're saying escape, I think so often teachers, they hear that and they're like, well, they need to do this work. They need to, you know, behave a certain way. They need to participate. And escape, again, it's from the ABA perspective or the behavioral perspective, doesn't mean the same thing as, like, literally they don't have to do that work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, why are they escaping? And then it goes back to, well, oh, you don't know how to do this problem. Okay. And also too, guys, you have to be mindful. You have to, when a learner has a IEP and they're integrated in the special and the regular tier classroom, if a learner is in the reading section and they're at a kindergarten level and the class is reading Charlotte's Web and they're sitting for 25 minutes reading a paragraph and your kid literally has to sit there, what do you think they're going to do? Of course they're going to engage in some behavior because, you know what I mean? Why not? So you have to understand all the different variables that are going on around to really be able to set the environment up for success. And that's a lot of things that nobody talks about either. And it's like being in the field, it's like, oh, let me share this different perspective. Hello. Doesn't it make sense? Like, yeah, your kid can't sit for 20 minutes because they're supposed to, but they're not at that level. It's a skill deficit. So is it a skill or is it a will? You always ask yourself those two questions.
And so often I have heard school districts say, you know, and for anyone, so when she talked about the functional behavioral assessment, the behavior intervention plan, those are both two components of IEPs. They don't have to be, though. They can be done even on students without IEPs. And also, technically, right now, the law does not require those to be completed by a BCBA. They can just be completed by staff members, and it's a, you know, parents are involved and that sort of thing. And so when I see a lot of functional behavioral assessments, there'll be a question on there that will say, is it a skill deficit or a performance deficit? Mm-hmm. And I would say, without actually having a statistic of this, that 80%, probably 90% truly or higher, it's marked as a performance deficit. Because I feel that the schools think it is more will than skill.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience, what do you think? Is it about, what do you think the percentages are? Again, I know you don't have the statistics in front of you either as far as, is it skill or is it will in most instances?
For me, honestly, from my experience, I feel like it's usually like the skill, especially if they're not provided the accommodations and supports that they need to be successful, that is going to play a huge role, 100%. And it could be a little mix of both, but it really depends on the learner. Everything has to be individualized. So when it comes to percentage, like I'm used to working with, elementary, and then I had a consult for a middle school. And that's also something to be mindful, guys, that transition from elementary to middle school. Okay, you have a child that's used to being in one classroom with 26 of the same kids. You go to middle school, guess what? There's 7 different classrooms, 7 different hallways to navigate, 7 different teachers with 7 different teaching personalities and styles. But also you have a classroom of 25 kids, maybe even more, times 7. So can you understand the overstimulation and all the different things that's going on in the environment that nobody is mindful of? And being able to perform an FBA for somebody in the middle school, I was able to see what's occurring during each transition and actually bring that to the table, because a lot of like, oh, well, he's always late to work. I mean, to after gym class. Well, did you know that the gym teacher actually allows him to stay 5 minutes to hang out when he does have a good session? So now he's going to math class 10 minutes late, and now he's upset because they already started the class, and now he's frustrated and doesn't know what to do because you see what I mean? But nobody is understanding what's going on in that full lens. So there's a lot of different variables and components to be mindful of that can have a huge influence on the behaviors.
Yeah. And when and in talking about it being a skill deficit, it doesn't necessarily mean an academic skill. It can be that social or that behavioral skill, like you said, of the student who is screaming and hollering and you know, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. It's stupid, whatever. When they haven't learned the skill of it's okay. This regulation. Is how I ask for help.
Listen, emotional regulation, advocacy, functional communication training. This is why early intervention is crucial. Okay. Like, I cannot stress this enough. You need to focus on emotional regulation, functional communication training, transitions, advocacy, right? These are all things that you need to be, that learner needs to be successful at. Because if you're trying to get academics done and they don't have these targets mastered, you're never going to get academics done because they have to learn to process what they're feeling, that emotional piece. Oh, I'm getting a little upset right now. Okay, so let me know. Do you need help? Do you need want me to go first or do you want you to go first? You know, do we need to take a couple of deep breaths? You have to practice these skills so that the learner can understand, oh, I need to advocate for myself right now. I need to ask for help. So before that learner has these skills mastered, don't expect to get academics done, especially if you have a learner that's constantly destroying the room. Is it a skill deficit? Yeah, the skill of not being able to emotionally regulate and communicate their needs. That's the deficit right there.
Right. And I know for here in Illinois, if we mark that it's a skill deficit, the response from the school has to be different than if we mark it as a performance deficit. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that plays into why it's almost it, more often than not, it seems to me at least, is marked as a performance deficit. Because then the school's approach is different. But you made a comment earlier about, you know, that the person trying to help the other one learn a different behavior, that shaping behavior, that we have to change. And I want to reiterate that even in the behavior intervention plan, it isn't about the different things that the child has to do. It truly is about these are the different ways that the adults are going to interact beforehand and mm-hmm. also afterward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So especially, like I said, it kind of goes back to like, if you've had this kid in your class for the past 3 months and you said you've tried everything, okay, well, how about you try a few of these skills at the same time instead of trying one thing at a time, right? It's like, always have, especially if it's a kid that's kind of like used to like pulling things off, have a clear, you know, working space, maybe sit him somewhere else. Insert yourself like, oh, every 10 minutes, he's always asking for help. So then every 6 minutes, just stop by, like give a little nonverbal cue. That is you initiating that attention, especially if the function is attention. So there's a lot of little mindful things to be like little tools and skills that you can kind of like navigate depending on the situation that you're at, right? But yeah, there's so many different strategies that you guys can implement in the schools proactively to really help our learners succeed and get familiar with the routine of school and your classroom and how you have it structured and set up. But you do have to change your behavior and be open to being consistent and giving it time to see if you do see the change, right? Because it's not going to happen overnight. And especially if it's been on this schedule and he knows this works. And then one day he's like, oh, let me try that. Oh, and now it's like, oh, you see a decrease because this skill that you are supporting is actually working for him.
Right. So do you work with teachers in school districts or do you solely work with families and individuals?
So I've worked with basically everybody. Especially when I was in a school setting, we were consulting with school districts. So we usually had like one, I was never like a school-based BCBA, but I was supporting our specific learners in the schools that we were in. And I would support the teachers and let them know like, okay, you see this, this is a trigger. This also too, guys, pay attention to precursor behaviors. That is going to be your SD, which we call in our field, or like your signal to insert yourself to prompt him to communicate his needs and advocate. Oh, do you need a little help? Do you want me to come in? So it's being that proactive, but also being mindful of what can trigger your kid. But also like, oh, I see him shaking his leg or he's getting a little inflexible. Let me call on him. And like, kind of like, it's a slow shaping process, but being mindful of what to look for is huge when it comes to supporting our kids, but also the teachers to change their behavior, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel that, you know, in undergrad, we're not doing a good job of teaching our teachers about these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because we've just learned so much more about it in the last 20, 25 years. And it just hasn't transferred and made its way into undergrad training. I think we need to offer this more for mm-hmm. our teachers as professional development, because I do a session called Understanding Behaviors, and I don't go into the ABA and all of that sort of thing, but I do talk a lot about what we've talked about today, and just the amount of people that come up to me afterwards and say, I never like thought about it like that. And most of the time it's teachers who have been teaching for a while. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we need to do more. And so if there are teachers watching, if you agree with that, I would love for you to reach out to me and let me know, like, yes, we need this kind of instruction in our school because our teachers aren't getting it. Or reach out to Christina. If, you know, she's in the Northeast, yeah. I'm in the Midwest. So, you know, and then both of us, I'm sure, can find you someone, or I myself can do training anywhere in the country and would. But if you yeah. need someone out West, you know, we can figure that out for you as well. Do you have that same sense that we need to give more training to our teachers?
Absolutely. That's exactly why I created my platform, because my platform is called ABA Made Easy with an E and a Z. It's like, no, we're going to break it down so that you guys can grasp these concepts, but it's going to resonate. You're going to have light bulb moments. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, that makes so much sense. And with my resources, I like to generalize what could look like in the school, what this could look like in the home, what it could look like in the community. You know what I mean? So that people can see exactly like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So my goal with my platform is to support teachers, especially the teachers that are with our learners full time. Think about it too, guys. The children are in school just like where I work 40 hours a week. They're in school 40 hours a week. So the adults in their environment are the ones that have to support them, because guess what? They come home. Mom doesn't come home after work. She's got to cook. She's got to cook a meal, do laundry, da 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 da. And then it's nighttime routine. The children do not have a lot of opportunities to have that social skills and be around 26 other kids when they leave home. So you have to kind of understand the picture of what role everyone plays in. And obviously it has to, the home and the school need to work together. So yes, I made my resources to really support teachers, support caregivers, support anyone that are supporting our learners to really understand how behavior works so that you can better support your kids, but also help your classroom or your home setting.
Right. So definitely here's the ways to follow you on all the social media. But then when you were talking about your resources, they could go to any of these websites, or is there a specific one that you would direct them to?
Yeah, go on my Stand store, because my Understanding Autism ebook is for free. And the last chapter, I give a ton of cool strategies super easy strategies. They're all evidence-based strategies that you guys can be mindful of and actually use in any of the settings. It's like, oh, okay, let me use this strategy. Literally, the easiest strategy that you guys are going to offer is giving choices. Give your learner choices. Yes, give them the control, guys. Oh, it's time for doing the math. Okay, do you want to start on the top of the page or should we start on the bottom? Do you want to take a left or should we take a right? Give the learner control, okay? A lot of our learners are seeking control. Think about it. They're in the school 7 days a week being told what to do. Sit down quietly. Go line up. Da-da-da-da-da. If you can give your learner some type of control, you're now building rapport with them because you're respecting their choice and giving them a say of, you know, what they can do. That is the best strategy anyone can use. Give a choice.
Yeah. And here's the kicker to that. I think I have to always remember to add is whatever choice they choose, honor it.
Honor it.
Because if you give them a choice and then they choose A and you're like, well, no, never mind. We can't do A. And then you still make them do B. You've completely decimated mm-hmm. any hope you had in that moment.
Yes. And in our field, we call it manipulating the environment, right? Now, here's that term, manipulating. Oh, you're going to manipulate the kid? No, I'm going to manipulate the environment so it's enriching. So, yes, I'm going to offer him, hey, do you want to do your math worksheet or should we do this math worksheet? That is manipulating the environment. I'm offering choice. I'm enriching the environment. I'm giving him control or her control. And now I'm building rapport because, hey, he's telling me what we're going to do next. I'm not telling him. And also, guys, you need to be mindful of the words that you're choosing. When you are working one-to-one with your learner, it's us and we. It's not he and she. So it's not he has to finish this worksheet before he goes outside. It's like, no, we got to finish this worksheet before we can go outside or whatever it is. So you have to change your mindset when you are supporting our learners and have that team vision, us and we, instead of he and she. Because the language that we use is going to absolutely influence how you're going to build rapport with the learner, but also how demanding it sounds. You got to finish your work, Shelley. We got to finish our work, Shelley. You see the difference?
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One word. So it's little things like this to be mindful of.
It is. And that's the other comment that I get after my sessions is, but some of these things are so simple. It's like, yeah. And you don't, it's weird because you don't think that giving these tiny little choices, these tiny little bits of control are going to curb these big, massive behaviors. Mm-hmm. But so often they do. It is that child, as you mentioned, they're, you know, oh my gosh. And like during the pandemic, nobody had control, but definitely kids, you know, it was such a confusing time. You can do this. You can't do this. Now you can do this, but with this accommodation. Well, now you can't do that with that accommodation. Now we've taken that away. And just giving that tiny little bit of, do you want to, you know, like you said, do you want to do the top, start at the top, start at the bottom? Do you want to, you know, kids don't even realize that they have those options. Mm-hmm. Because they're so used to, here's your paper, do it, and turn it in when you're done.
Yep.
And just it's giving just them quiet. Yes. And just giving that very simple, like, hey, you know what? By the way, if you're stuck on this one, skip that one. Come back to it later. Or, hey, if you want to start in the middle of the test, go start in the middle of the test. You know, but just those little things just help regulate. I mean, in actuality, that's what it's doing, is it's helping to regulate those emotions and that sense of who they are. Mm-hmm. And that helps overall.
And it helps build rapport with you and your learner, guys. It's all about rapport building a connection. Your learner needs to trust you, confide in you, know that feel safe with you. And also it's up to us to really empower our learners. Like, oh my God, you did amazing. Thank you for attempting. Always reinforce attempts. Don't worry about if they're successful or not. Like, thank you for trying. You know what I mean? Oh, that was awesome. You're so close, you know? And empower them to keep going and thriving. Like, progress over perfection. That should just be it. But we're making little baby progress. So.
Yeah, exactly. You don't yell at your two-year-old because they attempted to say their alphabet. You're like, yay, good job. You got, you know, A, B, and C down. Way to go. Mm-hmm. We think after a certain age, we can't continue to encourage. But if you think about marathon runners, there's more people at the end of the race to encourage them to finish than there are in the middle of the race. You have a whole bunch at the beginning, and then you have a whole bunch at the end and a few spattered in between there. Christina, I know you have to go because you do have another opportunity today. And so you and I could talk for hours. Without question. And I so appreciate you being here and giving of your time today. Is there anything, one final or two final things that you want to say to wrap up today?
I just think it's really important to not give up on our learners. Like, even if you feel like you've used every strategy, just be mindful of just giving that extra 1%. So just stay consistent, always try to be proactive, always be there to support and empower our learners to, you know, to keep going. And that's really offer choices. Find ways to give the learner some type of control, and especially in the school setting. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Just be consistent, be mindful, and really thrive to be proactive instead of more reactive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely 100% agree with that. Well, all right. Thank you, everyone who joined us today and who will join us in the replay. If you do have any questions for Christina or myself, be sure to leave the comments for us. And if there are any for specifically Christina, I will make sure that she gets them. I hope to see you all next time. Make sure you like and subscribe to the channel so you get notified every time I go live. Have a great week, everybody.
Hey parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykeno.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykeno.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.